From Tribune Tower, WGN Radio presents a conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything that's in the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for January 17th, 2016. Once again, thanks for joining me this morning as we take our weekly look at the politics of the past week and what's on tap in the days ahead. So on this chilly Sunday morning, make a quick grab for the Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee, and we'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. And, you know, Dave, I was spoiled by those 2 days in the 40s that we had.
Well, we all were. It was, of course, balmy by comparison.
I mean, I'd forgotten what it was like to bundle up until this morning coming into the Allstate Showcase studio here in Tribune Tower. And even as gloomy and rainy and dark as Friday was, you couldn't complain about the temperatures.
No, it was warmer. And the storm that we had a few days prior to that and colder temperatures, which kind of left us with some snow ice, all that went away. Very little snow in the forecast. Mike Hamernick was talking about some lake effect snow that could affect southwest Michigan and perhaps northern Indiana, but that's where it will stay. But we're dealing with wind chills down to 20 below overnight coming up. That's why we have a wind chill advisory going into effect tonight at 7. It'll be with us at least through noon tomorrow.
Yeah, and you know, I'm watching the flags over here on Michigan Avenue, and they are whipping. And,
I'm sure.
There's no better wake up in the morning than having a nice northwest breeze slapping you in the face. at 16 below wind chill is what we're at, I believe.
We are at 18 below now.
Good.
Temperatures, since I've been in here this morning, temperatures have actually gone down.
Yeah.
The official, a few hours ago at O'Hare, it was like 5 or 6. It is now down to 2 above. The highest temperature I'm looking at right now is in Valparaiso, Indiana, at 8 above. Our wind chill index now at 18 below, northwest winds at 16.
Wow. And and to think, I cooked out on the grill last night.
That's what you said.
Had a couple
of steaks.
You
said those porterhouse steaks. Yeah, that sounds pretty good.
Had a couple of porterhouse steaks out on the grill, and I thought, you know, I know we're going into the soup here, so I figured it may be a few days before the grill gets fired up again, but I'm actually making one of my Paul Prudhomme Cajun dishes for today that it's I guess the best way to describe it is it's Cajun chicken spaghetti. Okay.
What's the actual title of it, the name of it?
Chicken Big Mamu on Pasta.
Chicken Big Mamu, that's right.
It's a Paul Prudhomme favorite from his original cookbook, so a little homage to Paul Prudhomme today. And the thing is, and I was talking to Dave off the air about this, the longer it sits, and it's like a lot of things, the longer it sits, the better it gets.
Just like the coq au vin.
Yes, but the longer this sits, the hotter it gets. So by
we want hot right now.
Yeah,
we
exactly. And if you made it to Paul Prudhomme's true recipe and used all of the red, white, and black pepper in the amounts and the Tabasco in the amounts that he calls for, it's darn hot already. So I normally cut that back in half because there's leftovers, but each day you can see the kind of the temperature goes up a little bit more. And I used to make this for my daughters, and they loved it. And normally they're not really into spices and things like that. And that's the great thing about Cajun is it's not necessarily the heat, it's the flavor.
Exactly. There's a difference between it just being just plain hot.
Yeah, I mean, if you want hot, you can put hot sauce on anything.
Yeah, just dump the hot sauce on there. But there's a difference between being hot and being flavorful.
Yeah, and you get this combination of the three peppers together. Mm-hmm. And I cut it in half, but it noticeably builds, but it will make your nose run.
Those of us with colds and stuffy noses, that's a good thing.
And when the girls would have a cold, they'd ask.
They would go for that.
They'd ask for some Cajun spaghetti. And it's just wonderful stuff. And I'm looking forward to that tonight with sitting down in front of the TV and turning on the radio for the sound of John and Troy calling the Blackhawks.
For the Blackhawks.
As they go for 11 in a row.
Great.
11
Montreal tonight.
Yes.
Just as a reminder, pregame 5:30, face-off right here at WGN, 6 o'clock, John and Troy.
And, of course, we just beat Montreal at Montreal on Friday night, I believe it was, and then or Thursday night, I think it was. And then we had Toronto that we beat to get to 10 in a row, and now another original six matchup tonight. And at home too, so this will be good. This will be good, and we're in first place in the division. So let's let the good times roll. As
these are the things you have to look at positively in this cold weather. We're getting into what they call the dead of winter.
Well, this is hockey.
You're trying to be positive.
This is hockey weather.
It's definitely hockey weather.
Although, thank goodness you didn't use the newsroom Zamboni overnight here out on Pioneer Court.
I couldn't get it started. Somebody left it outside, uncovered.
Oh, no.
So I couldn't start it.
Well, it'll get a little bit warmer as the week develops after we get past another Monday kind of bitter cold. And maybe by then the get the WD-40 out and spray that on there and get the starter going, and we can be back to a little bit of normal.
Get the jumper cables out. Can't find the battery in these new cars these days.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and given some of the cars down in the Tribune loading dock, I'm not sure I'd want to hook up jumper cables to them. But, yeah, it's please, I don't know if you saw the kind of the WGN morning news viral video of my good friend Nancy Liu out last week on a cold day. I think it was 5 degrees out, and they tossed to a live shot, and I think she was right here out down on Michigan Avenue, and her live shot basically consisted of, "It's cold, don't be stupid."
I'm getting back in the truck.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's what it was.
And, I'm getting back in.
Yeah, and she received a standing ovation from the crew back at Bradley Place.
Talk about telling the story. That's it
right
there.
Well, that's right. That's right. So, again, I'd encourage everybody to follow Nancy Liu's advice. Don't be stupid out there.
Exactly, yeah. Once again, Rick, just real quick as a reminder to everyone, if people do need help, 311 is the number to call in the city of Chicago. There are warming sites in operation around the clock. So 311 for more information on that. And also be a good neighbor. Check on people who you think might need help too.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's make sure everybody stays warm and safe on this very cold weekend. Well, Dave's here to let us know what's happening on the news, traffic, and weather front. Producer Jasmine is fielding your phone calls, and you can reach us, as always, at 312-981-7200. That's also our text line. That's 312-981-7200. We're also on Facebook, facebook.com/thesundayspin, and on Twitter, @SundaySpin. Engineer Bob is looking for the knob to turn up the thermostat up here in the studio. And actually, I think the best part of this job today is wearing the headphones because it's keeping the ears warm. Just a reminder, too, you can find all of our past shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcasts at iTunes by searching for Rick Pearson. Well, coming up, we've got a great show today. After the 7:30 news, Martin Luby joins the show, and Marty's an assistant professor in the School of Public Service at DePaul University, and he'll discuss how the state's recent bond sale is costing you and I millions of dollars more than it should, and he'll tell us why. After the 8 o'clock news, Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, will be with us. Rob's not happy with some recent actions at City Hall, and he'll be here to share his concerns. And then after the 8:30 news from Dave, we'll be joined by the Republican leader of the Illinois Senate, Christine Redonio of Lamont. Senator Redonio has been critical in recent days of Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel, and she'll talk about that in the continuing deterioration of the state without a budget. That's all coming up, but first we're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to The Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. Reminder, the wind chill, it downtown, 18 below zero, so bundle up today. It's time for our weekly spin through national politics, and of course, we've got the news that Dave brought us that the prisoners that were freed as part of a prisoner swap with Iran, the four U.S. prisoners have left Tehran, including a Washington Post reporter. At the same time, as part of the swap, the U.S. released seven Iranians held on sanctions charges. And the U.S. agreed to drop charges against 14 other Iranians whose extradition seemed very doubtful. And, of course, the reaction from GOP presidential contenders ranged from Kentucky Senator Rand Paul speaking hopefully of diplomacy to Marco Rubio saying prisoner swaps incentivize foreign governments to take U.S. citizens hostage. Well, politically, this was a week bookended by President Obama's seventh and final State of the Union address and a State of the Republicans debate in South Carolina. And then tonight on NBC, it's the Democrats' turn to debate. As I said, it was Obama's final State of the Union address, and it's interesting in how he sought to point out highlights of his term in office while injecting himself into the Republican presidential campaign and trying to counter Donald Trump. Here's a quick run-through of some of the highlights of that speech.
I'm going to try to make it a little shorter. I know some of you are anxious to get back to Iowa. Anyone claiming that America's economy is in decline is peddling fiction. What is true, and the reason that a lot of Americans feel anxious, is that the economy has been changing in profound ways. I'm guessing we won't agree on health care anytime soon. But, oh, applause back there. Let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you think, John? Look, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on earth, period. If this Congress is serious about winning this war and wants to send a message to our troops and the world, authorize the use of military force against ISIL. Take a vote. It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. If we want a better politics, it's not enough just to change a congressman or change a senator or even change a president. We have to change the system to reflect our better selves.
That was the president's State of the Union address, and delivering the Republican response was South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley, and she is a prospective vice presidential contender. Though Haley sought to find a way for establishment Republicans to reach out to angry voters, many of them backing Donald Trump.
We need to be honest with each other and with ourselves. While Democrats in Washington bear much responsibility for the problems facing America today, they do not bear it alone. There is more than enough blame to go around. We as Republicans need to own that truth. We need to recognize our contributions to the erosion of the public trust in America's leadership. We need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken. And then we need to fix it.
Now, moving on to the Republican debate, Kentucky Senator Rand Paul was refused a seat at the children's table. Or actually, he was offered a seat and refused to take it. And that, of course, that would be the undercard debate. And as a result, he actually may have gained more publicity than if he had attended. Here's Rand Paul explaining his decision not to participate.
Well, we're going to take our campaign directly to the voters. I'll be in New Hampshire and in Iowa. We have a strong organization. In fact, I would make the argument that right now our public organization is stronger than any other candidacy in Iowa. So we do deserve to be first here. We just can't accept any kind of artificial designation that tells our supporters or voters in Iowa that we're not in the first tier.
Now, on the main stage, it was the increasing vitriol between Donald Trump versus Texas Senator Ted Cruz. And Cruz hit Trump over Trump's accusations that Cruz may not qualify constitutionally for president as a natural-born citizen.
You know, back in September, my friend Donald said that he had had his lawyers look at this from every which way. And there was no issue there. There was nothing to this birther issue. Now, Since September, the Constitution hasn't changed. But the poll numbers have. And I recognize that Donald is dismayed that his poll numbers are falling in Iowa. But the facts and the law here are really quite clear. Under longstanding U.S. law, the child of a U.S. citizen born abroad is a natural-born citizen. If a soldier has a child abroad, that child is a natural-born citizen. That's why John McCain, even though he was born in Panama, was eligible to run for president. If an American missionary has a child abroad, that child is a natural-born citizen. That's why George Romney, Mitt's dad, was eligible to run for president, even though he was born in Mexico. At the end of the day, the legal issue is quite straightforward, but I would note that the birther theories that Donald has been relying on, some of the more extreme ones insist that you must not only be born on U.S. soil, but have two parents born on U.S. soil. Under that theory, not only would I be disqualified, Marco Rubio would be disqualified, Bobby Jindal would be disqualified, and interestingly enough, Donald J. Trump would be disqualified.
Now, Cruz was born in Canada of a Cuban father and a U.S. mother. A lawsuit was filed Friday in Texas challenging Cruz's ability to run for president. And this birther argument also is the basis of a challenge to the candidacy petitions of Cruz and Florida Senator Marco Rubio in Illinois. As for Trump, he stood by his concerns at the debate.
This isn't me saying it. I don't care. I think I'm going to win fair and square. I don't have to win this way. Thank you. Lawrence Tribe and numerous from Harvard, of Harvard, said that there is a serious question as to whether or not Ted can do this, okay? There are other attorneys that feel, and very, very fine constitutional attorneys, that feel that because he was not born on the land, he cannot run for office. Here's the problem. We're running. He does great. I win. I choose him as my vice presidential candidate, and the Democrats sue because we can't take him along for
the ride. Well, at the undercard debate, businesswoman Carly Fiorina did her best to try to gain some attention. She quickly took a shot at Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton.
I'm not a political insider. I haven't spent my lifetime running for office. The truth is, I've had and been blessed by a lot of opportunities to do a lot of things in my life. And unlike another woman in this race, I actually love spending time with my husband.
Yes, a nice, I would say veiled shot at Hillary Clinton, but I don't think there was much of a veil on that one. Well, it's 27 minutes after 7 on this cold Sunday morning. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. I know Dave's getting ready for the news, but I got a chance to see I didn't stay up late enough to see the end of the Packers playoff game last night, so I got to see the highlights this morning, and what an unbelievable finish for a game. Aaron Rodgers throwing a Hail Mary pass with just a few clicks left to tie the game up, and then there's a foible with the coin flip, the coin toss for overtime, where the ref threw the coin, but it didn't flip, so he reflipped it, and then Arizona got the ball, and they went in for a touchdown. End of game. Arizona beats the Pack. So quite a game. Well, coming up on the Sunday Spin, Martin J. Luby, assistant professor, School of Public Service at DePaul University, will be talking about the state's recent bond sale and why you and I are going to have to pay lots more than we probably should have for it.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I know Dave said that it was 18 below as the official wind chill. I know there's a lot of hot air at the Tribune Tower, so when I was out on the Storm Center patio and checked the thermometer, it said it was 10 above. So a little bit of explanation here, but just a couple of things further on our spin through national politics. The race tightening up in Iowa and New Hampshire on the Democratic side between Hillary Clinton and Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. And Sanders has been launching an ad that takes on Hillary and Wall Street.
There are two Democratic visions for regulating Wall Street. One says it's okay to take millions from big banks and then tell them what to do. My plan, break up the big banks, close the tax loopholes, and make them pay their fair share. Then we can expand health care to all and provide universal college education. Will they like me? No. Will they begin to play by the rules if I'm president? You better believe it.
That's Bernie Sanders' ad in Iowa. Hillary Clinton, on her part, the night of the Republican presidential debate, she visited Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show. Fallon was recounting to her a recent visit to the show by Donald Trump and what he had to say about her.
I asked him, I said, how is Hillary? How do you think Hillary's doing? And he goes, not good. and he said, I haven't even started on Hillary yet.
Oh.
And I was just wondering, does he intimidate you, Donald Trump?
No.
See, you just gave me the look.
Yeah,
and that just intimidated me. Yeah, that look right there, yeah.
I mean, if I'm so fortunate to be the Democratic nominee, obviously I'll run against whoever they nominate. But if it's Donald Trump, it'll be quite the showdown.
That was Hillary Clinton on The Tonight Show. And that's our spin through national politics. Joining me now is Martin J. Luby, assistant professor from the School of Public Service at DePaul University, and also visiting senior fellow at the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. Marty, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
No problem, Rick. Thanks for having me on.
Well, Marty's a specialist in public financial management, the municipal bond market, public budgeting, and he spent 13 years before becoming an academic in the public finance industry as an investment banker and financial advisor to state and local governments. And I wanted to have you on because I know that you're preparing a report on the issue of Illinois bond sales and really what Illinois' miserable financial condition means as far as the taxpayers and kind of the penalty we're paying. Illinois last week sold its first bond offering in 20 months, and it sold $480 million in bonds. And part of the problem is we have this massive debt already. We don't have a state budget, which I understand in some of the salesmanship that was done by the state to these investors, bond investors, that they kind of downplayed that. But nevertheless, that's very present. And Marty, I don't know if you've had a check to run the numbers, but I know that bond sale had to cost Joe taxpayer millions of dollars more than it would cost other states.
Yeah, that's correct, Rick. So we have a report that's coming out. The title of the report is called Still in the Penalty Box, and it's called the $53 million Financial Condition Penalty on the Illinois General January 2016 bond sale. And that's exactly right. We calculated basically the additional or really the reduction in price that the state received on this bond deal compared to what it would have received when its credit ratings were higher. And we calculated that to be $53 million. So really the crux of the analysis is that if the state would have sold its bonds at its credit ratings 10 years ago when the state was rated in the double A range compared to what it's rated now, which is really basically in the triple B range, the state would have received $53 million more on this bond sale, on this $480 million bond sale today.
And that's at a double A rating, and of course – The Pride is having a AAA rating.
Right. You know, the state hasn't had a AAA rating in a long time. So, you know, the benchmark for us or the kind of the economic baseline for us really was the AA rating. And it really hasn't been that long when people think about it. The state had a AA rating. In 2008, it still had a AA rating. So it's only been within the last 10 years that its credit has deteriorated to the point where it's in the BBB rating. Category, and the state has the lowest credit rating of any of the 50 states in the United States.
And I noted in a Reuters report on this bond sale that the state, despite that penalty, still benefited somewhat because overall prevailing yields in the market have been relatively low. But certainly, and you've written about this in the past, we're going to be seeing, as far as any future bond sales, increasing interest rates as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple things going on there. I mean, the Bloomberg article is correct. The absolute level of interest rates was low on this bond sale, but it's low for everybody because interest rates have declined since the state was in the markets previously in 2014, and certainly since the state was AA rated in 2006. So on an absolute level basis, the total interest cost on the bond issue, I think, was about 4%. That's relatively low, or that's on an absolute basis, that's low. But on a relative basis, compared to what the state could have received, it's much higher, and it was basically compared to the highest rated bond, it was 1.61%. Over that. That's what leads to that $53 million penalty that we're calculating. And the challenge that in what you're alluding to Rick, correctly, I think, is what the challenge that the state has going forward is that it's going to have to issue a lot more debt in the future to deal with its infrastructure deficit. And this dollar penalty is just going to grow if the state doesn't improve its financial condition. The Institute for Government and Public Affairs had a report out a few months ago that estimated that the state was going to have to issue anywhere between $4 and $8 billion a year if it wanted to deal with its infrastructure deficit. If the state issued $4 billion worth of bonds, this financial penalty would increase from $53 million to $424 million, which is no small amount, even in the context of the state's $35 billion operating budget.
I don't think there is anything as such as a small amount for what the state is facing right now. What does this $480 million worth of bonds get us anywhere as far as digging out that infrastructure funding deficit that we're facing?
Well, it helps. I mean, the $480 billion actually is part of the old capital plan that was passed in 2011 by Governor Quinn. So it's dealing with projects that were identified and were set to be funded under the old plan, which expires in 2016. The state has a whole slew of obviously new projects and new maintenance and new infrastructure that it has to deal with. And the size of that deficit is so large that $480 million, while it helps, doesn't really address a major component of the infrastructure deficit.
Yeah, and I want to talk to you more about that issue of that infrastructure deficit, part of the report that was issued back in September about the kind of the third type of deficit that nobody looks at, and that's the importance of maintaining the adequacy of our public works, our public infrastructure. One of the things that, despite Illinois' fiscal condition, that's supposed to be one of its strong points, but has been badly overlooked as Illinois grapples with its budget. We'll be back with more with Assistant Professor Martin Luby from DePaul University and the Institute of Government and Public Affairs. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase Studio in Tribune Tower on Michigan Avenue. On the phone, Martin J. Luby, Assistant Professor, School of Public Service at DePaul University and a visiting senior fellow for the Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois. And we're talking about his report soon to be released, still in the penalty box? Is that what the name of it?
That is. That's the title. So it's still in the penalty box, the $53 million financial condition penalty on Illinois' January 2016 bond sale.
And we're talking about that bond sale, the state last week going to market, selling $480 million worth of bonds, and the fact that because of the state's poor credit rating, that penalty box, it's not a two-minute penalty. It's a $53 million penalty. It's a 30-year penalty, too, right?
Well, the analysis that we did was, on a present value basis. So the $53 million is a present value number. So it takes into account the time value of money. but, not to get too technical on that, but, of course, the additional interest cost that the state does pay, isn't just in 1 year. They pay that additional interest cost through the term of the bonds. And in this case, the bonds went out 25 years, so it's a 25-year penalty.
Okay. But, one of these points, and this goes back to that September report that the Fiscal Futures Project at the University of Illinois issued that you wrote, is that issue of the crowding out of money to pay for regular services because of the huge bonded indebtedness of the state, and one of the drivers of that isn't for infrastructure. It's because of those pension obligation bonds that were sold.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, the state obviously has a lot of crowding out of its operations and capital related to pension funding. So not only the amounts that the state has to put aside every year into the pension funds to deal with their unfunded liability, but also the state issued a series of pension obligation bonds, one issue in 2003, which was the big issue, the largest municipal bond issue in history, $10 billion in pension obligation bonds were sold in 2003, and then they issued $3.5 billion again in 2010 and 2011. So a lot of the bonded debt that the state has, a lot of the what we call the hard debt that the state has, relates to pensions. So in addition to the $111 billion deficit the state has to do on pension underfunding, and also has bonded debt that's related to that, that the interest payments and the principal payments that come due, the state has to pay, of course. And if they're paying payments on those pension bonds, they can't pay it. They can't pay interest and principal on repayment of other types of bonds, usually bonds that would be used for infrastructure and for capital.
Yeah, and that's why this the whole concept of POBs, the pension obligation bonds, was I think was controversial when it was brought up, was because for the most part, when the state does sell bonds, it is for long term. Capital investment for repairing roads, bridges, the kinds of things that the hard government projects, and that really by selling those pension obligation bonds, you're starting to borrow for day-to-day operations, which, you know, back when I first started covering government, that was an ultimate no-no. You didn't do that. And yet that was what the state did, was in order to kind of escape its pension direct pension obligations and free up money for what people would think of as normalized government services.
Yeah, I think that's generally correct. I mean, there's arguments to be made that they were going to have to pay that money back anyways into the pension funds to reduce their unfunded liability. These bonds allowed them to kind of stretch that out a little bit and kind of ease the pain of having to pay larger amounts into the unfunded into their pension funds. But basically the same effect is true. There is a crowding out and there is a trade-off. To the extent that you're paying back debt related to pensions, you're not going to be able to pay back debt related to capital, meaning that you're not going to be able to issue as much capital improvement bonds. So that's a real challenge. And in the context of the state's deteriorating infrastructure condition, it's a trade-off that I think the state and policymakers and the public need to be increasingly more aware of.
Well, and one thing, too, when it comes to infrastructure, and as you mentioned, this most recent bond sale was done under the previous program, which has a dedicated revenue stream, although there was some question about, I believe, video poker as part of that revenue stream and whether the revenues were coming in based on forecast to cover that. But as we look forward, you know, we're looking at the state without a state budget. We're looking at huge cuts in services as well as a large tax increase to try to just get out of the current annualized budget hole. But then when you look at the deterioration of the public works in this state and the need to sell bonds for that, and that's typically done with some kind of a dedicated revenue stream as well, isn't it?
That's the way the state of Illinois has done their capital programs. They've identified new revenue streams to pay for the additional bonding and the additional kind of pay-as-you-go funding. So those revenue streams have not been identified. So you're exactly right, Rick. We have, a deficit related to pensions. We have a deficit, a mismatch just between our regular kind of operating budget, or what we call a structural budget deficit. And then we have this infrastructure deficit, too, which, as far as I know, I'm sure the legislature and the governor's office are talking about these issues, but there hasn't been any issues. There hasn't been any revenues that have been identified in public that is going to fund this deficit. So people need to be aware of that there's, in addition to dealing with these other deficits that we increasingly hear about in the media related to pensions and in the operating budget deficit of the state, there's this other deficit where they're also going to have to identify new revenues for that as well.
Yeah, and You know, in the past, there have been issues about raising the gas tax, those kinds of things. And, of course, you know, and we're seeing that on a national level, even though that we now have a new long-term federal transportation funding bill. Even that, there's questions of the adequacy of funding that on the federal gas tax. And now, you know, you're looking at the gasoline prices falling. Some reports say that we could even see a return of dollar gasoline. But that doesn't get anybody anything as far as an era where you've got vehicles that go so much further on a mile per gallon gas basis that, you know, I think it's almost inevitable that we're likely to see at some point an increase in the motor fuel tax here in Illinois. And perhaps after the presidential campaign, one on the federal level as well.
Yeah, that's obviously that has been the source that historically state and federal government has tapped to pay for funding. But you correctly identify the challenges associated with that. People are driving less; they're driving more efficient vehicles. They're not consuming as much gas, and thus because the gas tax is on a per gallon basis. Mainly, I mean, there's a portion of what that is on a percent on a price basis, but mainly it's on a per gallon basis, that tax isn't going to be sufficient to deal with the infrastructure needs of the state or the federal government. And obviously what makes this even harder is that at both levels of government, we've not dealt with this issue, both at the federal level and at the state level. So this deficit is very, very large. So you combine the lack of funding or a lack of a sustainable revenue source to fund this infrastructure, and the infrastructure being so large, and you have a situation where you're going to need probably some alternative funding, probably some creative funding approaches, and they're going to have to be user fees or taxes that are very large.
And kind of going along with that, and this, I know these were, I believe, 2014 numbers, but when you did that report in September, and you look at the where the states rank in terms of tax-supported debt, and you've got Illinois ranking in ninth place on percent of personal income, 5.6%. You've got Illinois ranking seventh in per capita tax-supported debt. How does that affect our competitiveness as far as a state?
Well, debt in and of itself isn't a bad thing. Obviously, the state has a relatively high debt burden, and what people need to realize is that that debt burden has gone up in the last few years. It wasn't always that the state of Illinois was on the very high side of debt burden. What the challenge is that when you combine the debt burden, the hard debts, the bonded debt burden with the state, and then all the other liabilities and fiscal challenges that it has, it obviously kind of creates this perfect storm whereby the state is really fiscally challenged. And then when you add in the political dysfunction into the mix, it's not surprising that the rating agencies have recently downgraded the state, have continually downgraded the state since 2008, recently downgraded the state in the context of this bond issue. And two of the rating agencies, or at least two of the rating agencies, have the state on a negative outlook. So, you know, there's lots of challenges ahead for the state from a fiscal perspective. I think everyone recognizes that. I think the point of the report that we're releasing on Tuesday is we really wanted to put a dollar figure to it, just like we did in the September infrastructure deficit report, because people, I think, understand this concept of the state is struggling financially, but they don't know what it means in dollar terms. And hopefully our report advances that dialogue.
That's Assistant Professor Martin J. Luby from the School of Public Service at DePaul University, visiting Senior Fellow, Institute of Government and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois, trying to put a handle, to put a figure where we can kind of grasp the continuing deterioration of the state of Illinois when it comes to its fiscal solvency, I think is a fair way to say it, isn't it?
I think that's exactly right.
All right. Professor, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
No problem. Thank you for having me on, Rick. Appreciate it.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome to the second hour of the Sunday Spin. I was glad to hear that the wind chill has dropped from 18 below to 17 below.
I still want to go swimming.
You are crazy.
Well, it's not freezing. It's 33.
Well, you, if you want to go, we'll be glad to watch.
Our own version of the polar plunge.
Sure, we can. I'm sure we can get this on video if you'd like.
You don't want that on video. You don't want that on video.
Oh, please be careful out there. It is dangerous out there.
I drove by the Lincoln Park Lagoon yesterday, and there were ducks walking on the ice.
Yes.
And portions of the lakefront actually were a bit frozen yesterday.
Which
so.
We haven't seen that in a while.
No, we haven't. And this is, I would imagine, this is by far the, you know, the lowest temperatures we've seen all winter this winter. And they'll be with us for another couple of days. As we mentioned, that wind chill advisory going into effect tonight, it'll be with us through noon tomorrow because we're going to see wind chills down to 20 below or more.
Oh, boy.
For the overnight hours and into tomorrow. So, get ready.
Yes.
If you're not ready now, get ready.
You better be ready by now. And, of course, as you said earlier, we knew it was coming. You know, it is Chicago.
Oh, yeah. It's mid-January. Of course it was coming.
But I'll say one thing, and I noticed this yesterday after I was leaving for show prep, is that it is actually getting lighter, longer.
Slowly but surely.
You know, it's not
slowly
pitch,
but surely.
Pitch dark, and it's also getting lighter earlier as
mm-hmm.
well.
Yep.
So look at the positives here. We're, you know, we're on the downslide.
Yeah, I told somebody last week I have to start my countdown to spring training for baseball.
Oh,
that always is something to look, you know, gives us a glimpse into warmer days ahead.
And, of course, the Cubs convention going on.
Cubs convention right now, yeah.
Yeah, so, yes, their warmer days are ahead. Thanks, Dave.
Anytime. Well,
thanks for that positive note. Joining me now on the Sunday Spin is Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. And, Rob, thanks for getting up with me this morning.
Hey, Rick, it's always a pleasure to be with you.
So I understand there's a bit of controversy going on, as if we don't need any more controversy at Chicago City Hall, but a bit of controversy going on over a provision that Mayor Rahm Emanuel is seeking regarding the taxation of tobacco products in the city of Chicago. Can you fill us in what's going on?
Yeah, well, Rick, the city council, and at the behest of the mayor, introduced a proposed ordinance that would increase the age at which you can purchase cigarettes from 18 to 21 years of age. They would also put a tax on other tobacco products. So they have a tax on cigarettes, which they're allowed to do under state law. They do not have a tax on other tobacco products, which are things like smokeless tobacco, loose leaf tobacco, and little cigars. There's some significant legal question whether they have that authority, but they're proposing it nonetheless. But most controversially in this proposed ordinance, they are proposing a minimum floor price. So for the first time, certainly in Illinois, the city of Chicago is determined that it is knows best how to price a product for retailers.
So the city is determining how much the floor is for the sale of tobacco products.
Right. So they're saying in this ordinance that, for example, for cigarettes, the price has to be at least $11.50 per pack, that it has to be $11.50 for a 1.2-ounce can of smokeless tobacco. That comes out to about $9.58 per ounce. The same is said for smoking tobacco. So they're telling us that you can't sell it below this price and that you can't discount it, you can't put it on sale, you can't use coupons, that the minimum price that you can charge has to be this amount. And in the case of cigarettes, $11.50.
Is that because they can then try to maximize the tax revenue off that?
Well, Rick, it's interesting that you went there first because that's exactly where my mind went when I first read it. It's a great way now they can just simply start raising the price instead of ever having to raise the tax and try to avoid the nasty headlines that come with that.
But what legal authority exists for setting a minimum floor price, a government setting a minimum floor price for a product?
Well, there certainly doesn't seem to be a prohibition on it. because they'll argue that they're not setting a price, that they're just setting a minimum floor price, that the retailers can do anything they want to do above and beyond that price. There is some precedent in a couple other states for this. Wisconsin, for example, does have a minimum floor price for things like dairy products. It's a Depression-era law. It was designed to protect their dairy industry.
Yeah, it was a dairy support for their leading industry in the state.
Correct. But it's interesting to note that historically, these minimum floor prices have gone the way of the dinosaurs. Everybody understands that when government shouldn't be in the process of setting prices, that were they to do this for other things, consumers pay more than they ordinarily would. We would have missed out. Consumers would have missed out on the competitiveness of the grocery industry, for example, which, you know, depending what your view is on it, you certainly consumers can. No one can argue that consumers aren't benefiting from the competitive nature of the grocery industry. So the minimum floor price is just a terrible way. And I just am flabbergasted at how the city of Chicago believes it has the expertise to determine what ought to be the pricing in a store for any product.
Well, as you said, and these came from like the idea theory comes from Depression era. I mean, if you want to talk about dairy supports, there was a time when the government decreed that margarine couldn't be yellow because it would unfairly look like it was butter. I mean, what's to stop government from, you know, say we were just talking with Marty Luby about infrastructure. What's to stop the government then from determining a minimum gasoline price to maximize tax revenues out of motor fuel taxes?
There's absolutely nothing to stop that if they were to decide they wanted to do that. And again, I think at the end of the day, the consumer pays the price. Because anybody that comes along that has a better method of business, a better way of conducting business, that's more efficient, that brings the products to the market more cheaply, the consumer misses out on that because in this case, or in your example, gasoline, let's say, they'd have to charge a minimum price for that gasoline. And so we just think it's horrendous. And again, you look at what you mentioned in your opening, the city of Chicago facing all of the problems it's facing, can't manage many of the programs and institutions that are under it, yet somehow it has the expertise to manage pricing on individual products is just mind-boggling.
We're speaking with Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson here in the Allstate Showcase studio on a chilly Michigan Avenue at Tribune Tower. And I'm sure much warmer on the phone is Rob Carr, the president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association. Rob, I was just thinking, what's to stop the city from setting a minimum temperature, you know?
Well, if they were, I would certainly support something in the neighborhood of San Diego, you know, 75 degrees a year round.
Well, so we were talking about this issue of, in an effort to generate $6 million, the city is determining that there shall be a minimum floor price for tobacco products sold in the city of Chicago, which leads to the question of where is the issue of competitiveness, of retailer discretion, manufacturer discounts, as you said, coupons. I mean, this seems to be, and I guess maybe the fundamental question is, because it's tobacco and because of the controversial nature of tobacco products and the expressed desire by politicians to have people get off tobacco, have them quit smoking, whether this is like an easy suspect to try to put this minimum pricing issue on?
I think you hit it right on the head. It is an easy one to go at. I think typically, unless you're a smoker, tobacco engenders no real support, if you will, among the general public. So the general inclination is, yeah, why not? Until you start thinking about, wait a minute, if they do it with this product, what's the next product? Likely alcohol. Then what? the snowball starts down that hill. And we're assuming that their revenue estimates are correct. We're trying to figure that out now, but it seems to me that their estimates might be a little lowball here. But there is nothing to stop them from continuing this trend. And as we talked about in the first segment, Rick, this is done in complete absence of knowledge of any business's cost inputs. They have no idea of all the other things that are going into any particular, in this case, retailer's cost of doing business. And no cost of doing business is the same, is identical for every retailer. It depends on their size, depends on the complexity of their operations. And it also doesn't take into account the fact of what the city's doing on the cost side for businesses. They are killing city businesses right now, particularly those in the neighborhoods and in the retailers, with their artificially imposed mandates, such as minimum wage. You have the county doing the property tax, the sales tax. They're talking about at the city level paid time off and scheduling restrictions. The list goes on. So they're really pinching their employers from both sides. And then to now say you have to price a product at a certain level, it's starting to get to the point that some are going to look around and just ask who they should hand the keys to at City Hall.
Well, and we know very well the whole issue of property taxes and the city property tax increase and how it was sold as a way to basically it would affect the booming downtown more than it would affect others. But the retailers have that to pay as well.
Yes, they have all of that to pay and absorb, and we've already been told, you know, that this is probably the first round of property taxes. And as you know, and most of your listeners know, in the city of Chicago, commercial industrial properties pay 2.5 times more than their residential counterparts. So an unusually heavy burden falls on that on the employers in the city and the county that doesn't fall anywhere else. And we should note, Rick, that they're looking for $6 million here to fund an educational program that is near and dear to the mayor's heart, and it may be a very valuable program. But, you know, once again, we have to question why they can't look first at internal efficiencies. As the Tribune covered a week or so ago, you know, Chicago Public Schools headquarters spent nearly $3 million last year on catering. Now, I'm not begrudging the fact that occasionally you have to have a staff working, you know, lunch or something, but you've got half the money right there for the $6 million program.
Well,
going down this path. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, and you also, there's the report from the Better Government Association about the closed schools, and they can't find any of the equipment, not a lot of the equipment, that was going to go from those schools to other schools.
Yeah, and so it's hard to imagine that between those two alone, you can't find the $6 million for this product or for this project. From your current spending, why this has to become the Trojan horse, if you will, for government to start mandating price controls is beyond me.
Well, and you also have the issue too of the in Cook County, the increase in the sales tax going back up, back to the Stroger tax levels too, which that certainly has to have an impact on Cook County regional retailers.
Oh, most certainly it does. It's not hard to take your shopping just across a border and pay a noticeably different sales tax. And we know, recently, because of the state's problems, they weren't paying lottery winners who had won over more than $600. Well, there was a noticeable fall off of lottery sales in Illinois and a noticeable spike in border communities, such as in the Quad Cities, over the border in Wisconsin, just across from Rockford, in Lake County, Indiana, and in the Quad Cities across from the Metro East. All of them experienced spikes. People clearly are willing to travel. If they're willing to travel for a lottery, you bet they're going to travel for a higher sales tax. And once they're over there for one item or two items, they're going to be over there for others. So it really becomes a self-defeating philosophy.
I was just going to say, no one goes just for one thing. And while they're there, and when you start looking at various pricing differences, much of it caused by taxation, things like cigarettes, things like liquor, those vice taxes kinds of things, then the revenue estimates that, you know, I've always wondered what the cost-benefit analysis really comes down to on those kinds of things.
Yeah, it's very hard to track it all entirely because you will always see a spike when somebody has a tax increase, but you always then, particularly as we've seen in the city of Chicago, after every cigarette tax increase, then they slowly have a the tax revenue slowly declines over time. So it does. It clearly shows that sales shift elsewhere.
Well, let me ask you this, Rob. With this issue of a mandated minimum price, is there any effort to look at this as far as any kind of a lawsuit?
Well, that will have to be a decision that others our membership will make, that others will make. We'll have to take a look at that and how that gets funded. That is clearly part of the discussion. And I think it's unfortunate that once again, the city's kind of reaction is, catch us if you can, is the approach they're taking. They're taking that on minimum wage. There's some question whether they have that authority. They're taking that in other areas of regulation. And now they're doing it once again here. And it's a little disheartening. That they also add that cost then into the cost of doing business for employers in the city who have to undertake expensive lawsuits and time-consuming lawsuits in order to have correct public policy.
Well, what is the relationship between the retail community and in Chicago and City Hall? I mean, were there any conversations about any of those issues, including this most recent one about the minimum pricing? Has there been any conversation prior to just seeing this show up in an ordinance?
In terms of what we're talking about today, the minimum floor pricing, it just showed up in an ordinance. There have been no return phone calls from the mayor's office, so no, there has not been any communication.
What about as far as that minimum wage issue, though?
Well, there was communication on the minimum wage issue. I mean, they let us know what they were going to do. They let us know they were doing it and what they were going to do. There was no effort to try to temper it in any way. They had the Working Family Working Group for the issue of paid time off and scheduling and some other issues that they're coming out with. We were a part of those discussions, a minority part of those discussions, but a part nonetheless. But communication is decidedly one way on most issues.
That's our city that works. Rob Carr, president and CEO of the Illinois Retail Merchants Association, thank you for bringing this issue to everybody's attention, and thanks for joining me this morning.
Rick, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for having me, and stay warm.
You too. We'll be back with more right after this. Up ahead on the Sunday Spin, Christine Redonio, the Republican leader of the Illinois Senate, lawmaker from Lamont, and we'll be talking about the latest in the ongoing Springfield stalemate, as well as some recent public appearances in which she's had some pretty harsh words to say about Mayor Rahm Emanuel and his leadership of Chicago, as we see further the entrenchment of Republicans and Democrats in the Illinois legislature as we move ever closer to the March 15th primary, as well as the general election table being set for November.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Welcome back to the Sunday Spin, 8:35 on this chilly Sunday morning. I'd say brisk, but that would be an understatement. It is very cold out there. That wind is whistling through the caverns on Michigan Avenue, and everybody just bundle up, stay warm. A good day to turn on the fireplace and watch some sports, and of course watch to see the Blackhawks go for 11 in a row tonight. And you can hear the pregame here on WGN at 5:30 with John and Troy, with all of the action starting at 6 o'clock from the United Center tonight as the Hawks take on the Montreal Canadiens in an original six game. Well, joining me now on the Sunday Spin is Christine Redonio. She's the Republican leader of the Illinois Senate, a lawmaker from Lamont. Senator, thank you for getting up with me this morning. Hope it's all warm where you're at today.
Well, it's not too warm. The coffee's warm.
Good enough. That's a good start.
Right.
It's a cold dash for the Sunday paper this morning, that's for sure.
That's right.
I wanted, before we talk about more state issues, I don't know if you had a chance to listen to Rob Carr from the Retail Merchants was on with me in the last segment talking about...
I did listen to him, yeah.
Okay, and this effort to basically determine a minimum price for tobacco products in a municipality, it just sounds like there's a lot of legal questions surrounding that, and is there anything the legislature might want to take a look at with that?
Well, I do think it's a very slippery slope. They really kind of have a I think, a dual purpose here. One, they'd like to raise revenue, but as you two discussed, I think that's sort of a zero-sum game as people move their purchases to less costly venues, and that's easily done. The other reason that cigarettes in particular are an easy mark is because there is the public policy health benefit of trying to dissuade people from quitting. But again, that's at odds with the revenue piece of it.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and with these vice taxes, it's like trying to have it both ways sometimes.
Exactly. And it doesn't work. And we've seen that, too, as we've raised the tax on cigarettes in the state. That is a declining revenue stream as people both quit and move their purchases.
And there's also a generational evolution, too, I think, that exists with that as well.
Oh, there's no question about it. People are well aware at this point that cigarettes kill. And I think that I recently read that we're at a point now where fewer high school students than ever are smoking. So I think kids have gotten the message. So a lot of the policy that we put in place, the education efforts, increasing the prices, and I think the effort across the nation to raise the purchase age, all are doing their job in getting people not to start.
Maybe to segue from this issue of the mayor's office trying to do this to the mayor himself, you were at the City Club of Chicago last week, where you had some pretty harsh words about Mayor Emanuel's leadership of the city of Chicago.
Well, yeah, I really did. I mean, I think that people have been monumentally disappointed in him. I mean, here he was, someone who sort of came in from the outside, if you will, although certainly supported by the Democrat infrastructure in the state, but seemed to be a guy who was bright and had managed things in D.C. And there was, I think, a lot of hope that he could turn the city around, particularly financially. Even when he came in 5 years ago, we knew that the city was on a path that was not a good one, to say the very least. But as time has gone on, I think he's disappointed on every single level. I mean, I think the city is far worse off today than when he came in financially. And then, of course, we have the just confounding situation of the violence in the city, and that seems to be accelerating as well instead of getting better. So I would say that he's been a tremendous disappointment to people.
I know that certainly the mayor is looking for a lot of financial help from the state of Illinois. I've also kind of publicly questioned whether that's necessarily a good idea, since the state has its own issues. And of course, here we are still talking about the lack of a state budget. But the fact that, you know, you're looking at $480 million in money or relief for the Chicago Public Schools, money for mass transit, money to alleviate some pension costs for city government. And I know that Governor Rauner has said he's willing to help, but you've got to help me. And is given the where Rahm Emanuel is and what many have said is a crisis of confidence in Chicago governance, is that even a realistic idea of Rahm being able to play some kind of a broker role?
Well, I actually think he could perhaps change the conversation about Chicago if he took a leadership role in trying to partner with the governor to change things. I mean, his approval ratings are horrific. And so maybe he could change what they're talking about if he actively sought to partner with the governor to not only once and for all help Chicago, but also help the state onto a more sustainable fiscal path, which is what the governor is trying to do.
But you have the fundamental issue again of the elements of the governor's turnaround agenda that Emanuel says he's unwilling to be a part of, particularly those that are the more union weakening provisions. And you've seen kind of this ratcheting up of the rhetoric between the governor and the mayor, which does not seem to be helpful towards trying to go where everybody needs to go and getting some kind of an agreement.
Well, that's true. I mean, you know, the rhetoric is not particularly helpful, but really we don't have a lot of choices in the situation that both the city and the state are in. I mean, when you think about it, there really are only four options. The Republicans can walk away from reform and say, okay, we're just going to go ahead and give the city the bailout that it needs and, you know, on to another day. We would capitulate. That's not an option for Republicans. It's not an option for the governor. We will not do that. We have to have fundamental change in the state. Now, the Democrats, as you know, in Springfield have supermajorities in both chambers. So if they want to go ahead and impose a gigantic tax increase on the people of the city and the people of the state and continue to do what they're doing, the status quo, where they, you know, can't handle the finances as it is, that's another option. They can just override the Republicans. So Republicans can capitulate, Democrats can override. We can stay in this mess and end up with a $25 billion hole at the end of 3 years, which is what the governor's budget office has just projected will happen if we stay in this. Or the Democrats can come to the realization that the people in the state voted for some change and come to the table and, unlike what the mayor is saying, I'm not going to be part of the turnaround agenda, say, hey, let's take a look at some of these things. Maybe they make sense, and really engage in a discussion about change for the state.
Well,
that's what we're looking at.
I mean, you've been in these meetings of the four tops, or I guess the last one was the three tops since since Madigan wasn't there, but the four top lawmakers and the governor. And I just get the sense that it's just a matter of everybody has, and I'm talking about this on all sides, is everybody has their talking points, and that's as far as anything really goes.
There really is not a lot of genuine engagement, and that's the problem. I know there's a lot of focus on why don't we get together. Well, we could sit in a room, you know, from now until the cows come home and still have nothing happen. The decision has to be made. On the Democratic side, the mayor of Chicago and Mike Madigan in particular, they have to decide that this impasse is not good. And that apparently has not happened. I think, quite frankly, they are hoping this impasse is good for them politically in the long term, but it sure as heck is not good for the city and not good for the state. And until they make that decision, they are not going to engage in any real discussion about reform.
We're speaking with Illinois Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson. 8:47 on this chilly, brisk Sunday morning in downtown Chicago. I'm in the Allstate Showcase studio, nice and warm. On the phone, Christine Redonio, the Republican leader of the Illinois Senate. Leader, I wanted to kind of take what you touched on, the issue of the politics and the stalemate. And it seems to me everybody kept talking about, well, we get into January, it's you don't need as many votes to pass something. But at the same time, January, here we are, it's 2016, and people are already, you know, focusing on primaries, and then we've got the general election in November, and it just seems in a political atmosphere, it's much harder to try to bridge the gap here.
Well, that's true, but this is a political business, and it's always a political atmosphere. There's always an election around the corner. So I don't think the election per se is the political hang-up. I think it's a defense of the status quo. I mean, as you know, the Democrats have had control of this state for the last 13 years. They've had complete control of Chicago for over 80 years. What the governor is asking for fundamentally disrupts what their control has been based on. And so, and that goes to the heart of who their constituencies are, who funds their campaigns. And that's what I think is at the real heart of this. That's why I think that Mike Madigan is willing to let anything happen in the short term in order to preserve his power. And it really doesn't have to do with an election. It has to do with his power base.
But does it really come down to these union weakening provisions as having to be the, quote, structural reforms that are necessary to have all the dominoes fall into place?
Well, you know, when we talk about the union weakening reforms, and that's a very broad term, and I think what the governor is asking for is not unreasonable. I mean, at this point, he's taken the right to work stuff off the table. That was very offensive to many people. That's gone. What he's talking about now is simply giving localities a little more flexibility in terms of having a say over their own destiny, what they negotiate with their unions, not getting rid of them, but, you know, what are the things that they're going to negotiate? Interestingly, the Democrats have given Chicago the ability to determine some of those things. Now we're saying, hey, what about the rest of the state? For example, with education, and you know that that's a huge piece of the problem in Chicago. They've been able to privatize their janitorial services, yet the rest of the state is not able to do that and save any money. Now, the argument can be made, well, it didn't work, you know, they didn't have a good contract in Chicago, but that's no reason to not even allow that option for the rest of the state. So, again, the Democrats, when it serves their purposes, will do something with unions, but they deny that opportunity to the rest of the state.
Well, and there's also provisions about whether prevailing wages should be paid for construction projects on public works. And I have to wonder if there isn't some sort of a compromise that couldn't be reached on maybe setting a certain level of a project cost or something that might be able to be compromise.
When you talk about prevailing wage, I mean, that's a big nugget there. Many states, in fact, I believe 42 other states have some limitation on prevailing wage without getting rid of it. And I think, again, the governor has indicated time and time and time again, he is willing to compromise. But the Democrats just say, well, that's off the table. We're just not going to touch that. And that's not really the basis for a good negotiation.
So we're looking at an issue, you know, everybody throughout this whole impasse have been looking at pressure points, and pressure points that for the most part didn't really materialize, part of that being most notably when the governors did sign the one portion of the budget that dealt with elementary and secondary education. But now, speaking of elementary and secondary education and what is confronting the Chicago public schools, and now we're starting to, we thought it might be January, but it looks like it could be February, where it could be that point where we're looking at massive school closures, massive teacher layoffs, potentially a teacher's strike. Do you think that's the pressure point next?
Well, it's just a darn shame that we have to get that far, but it may be a pressure point. My concern, quite frankly, though, is that the power status quo in this state and in the city of Chicago is so important to the Democrats that they would allow that kind of disruption to happen to the education of hundreds of thousands of Chicago school children and still not be willing to make the changes that need to be made. But I, you know, we keep thinking that pressure point is looming, and as you point out, Chicago Public Schools have continued to pull rabbits out of the hat, if you will. They borrowed the money to make their pension payment last June. They want to borrow money again to get through the spring on without having to lay off any teachers. That borrowing is just compounding the problem, though. And, again, I think the goal here is to maintain the status quo.
Well, and then, of course, we just saw, you know, another round of borrowing coming through for city government as well. And
right.
I mean, and when we started the show, we were talking about the issue of the bonding that the state just sold $480 million worth of bonds, but also given the state's financial problems. Professor Martin Luby from DePaul calculated that that bond sale will cost us an extra $53 million in penalties, which doesn't sound like a great deal of money, but frankly, we don't have $53 million to give away, even over a 25-year period, based on the state's bond rating. And, you know, it raises those questions of, is it, how much longer can we kick a can down the road when that can is, there's not much left of the can. I think it's down to a pop top now.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, Chicago public schools are even worse off than the state. So the premium that they will have to pay to borrow will be much greater than what the state is borrowing. Their bond rating is junk status. The state is not at junk status. So the premium they pay will be extraordinary, and their budget is smaller than the state's. So relative to their budget, it's going to be a huge waste of money for them to continue to borrow that way. I mean, I think we need to be talking about other options for the Chicago Public Schools. You know, there's things we could talk about, such as the ability for them to declare bankruptcy, which many people think they are currently insolvent. We actually have a mechanism in the state right now where the state takes over school districts that are unable to manage their finances. That might be another route to go. But for them to continue to borrow at extraordinary rates, if in fact they're able to make the bond sale, which they may be able to do, is just compounding the problem. And as you said, that is going to come home to roost. And when it does, it's going to be even more expensive to fix than it is right now.
Do you think that the state should take a look at taking over the finances of the Chicago Public Schools?
I think that's an option we should at least explore. I mean, when you see some of the mismanagement that continues to come out in the press, I know that as I listened to the previous segment talking about the lost equipment, the catering bills, the whole Barbara Bennett Boyd situation, it's hard for me to believe that the Chicago Public Schools are being managed well, with the primary goal being the education of those children.
That's Illinois Republican Senate Leader Christine Redonio from Lamont. Leader, thank you for joining me this morning.
Well, thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. That's all we have time for on this week's edition of the Sunday Spin. I want to thank my guests, Martin Luby, Rob Carr, and Leader Christine Redonio, Senate Republican leader. And also, I want to thank all of you for listening. And, Dean, I'm going to have to go venture out into the cold.
I see, you've got your parka on already.
You know, it's just looking outside. I've had my jacket on like the whole show.
You've got your hood on?
Yes.
What are you, Nancy Lou?
Don't be stupid.
Are you a TV reporter standing on an expressway overpass? It's cold out there. You better.
I don't have the big furry hat.
Well, you should. You should. You know what? I bought one of those big furry hats
really?
This week.
From where?
I bought it at Renovation Hardware of all places.
Really? Okay.
Yeah, they had a really nice, cozy, warm hat, inexpensive, and I look like the biggest dork in the world wearing it. And I haven't. At some point this winter, I won't care how stupid I look.
Oh, well, I'm well past that. Yeah. I mean, on days where it's just going to be cold, it's like, no offense to those of you who have to do the TV, but if I know I don't have to be in front of a camera,
right.
It's not about looks.
Have you seen our show? Most of us don't care about how we look anyway. I'm a good old ski cap man myself. Keeps my noggin nice and warm. Well, everybody, stay warm out there if you haven't figured that out by yourself already.
Don't be stupid.
Hey, it's cold. You better bundle up. It's a minute after 9 on Chicago's. We've got all kinds of wisdom like that this morning. I'm loaded with wisdom. I'm full of wisdom this morning.
Full of wisdom.
I'm full of it.
Yes.
People have been saying for years. A minute after.